Okay, so let's start with the topics for today. We need to finish talking about group theory because last time I didn't have enough time to do what I wanted to do because of poor planning on my part. But that's okay. So we need to talk about the last part of the group theory that we need, which is quotient groups and the isomorphism theorem. And after that, we're going to talk about things that are more applications for actual physics, which is discrete, continuous, and infinitesimal symmetries. And then we're going to start leading the way to Noether's theorem, which, based on experience from this morning, we're not going to be able to do today. So we're going to do it on Friday instead. But we want to talk about what the symmetry of an action is, which is what Noether's theorem is all about. So that's the plan for today. And just a little recap of the things that are in the Google Drive folder. So first of all, things for last time, I added some things to Google Drive folder in case you didn't see them. I have the notes that I've wrote for both the morning and the afternoon session. So you can look at both sessions so you get to see things written a bit differently. Maybe if my A's and E's look the same, they didn't in the morning and the ops. So having my things written twice can help you decipher what I'm writing, and also some things are different, they may help you. I have solutions for the exercises I've given in case you didn't have time to finish them or you wanted to check if your solutions were correct. They're here. And I think that's all I added here. And for today, I have the links as last time. So any link that I'm going to be sending through the Zoom chat, you can also access it from here, just in case the Zoom chat doesn't work. I have people in the morning with this problem. And there's the empty slides we're going to use. They're actually the same as last time, but at least you can find them in one place. Actually, I think I removed the empty slide from last time. So you can follow along with the definitions and theorems so you don't have to write down everything. It's probably going to take too much time. Okay, so at this point we can start, unless you have any questions. And as usual, any questions, you can raise your hand virtually and Ivan is going to unmute you and let you speak, or you just write in the chat. Okay. So what are quotient groups and what's the isomorphism theorem? So first of all, we need the definition of a special kind of subgroup, which is a normal subgroup. Now, recall that we talked about subgroups last time. If we have a group and we have a subset of it, a subgroup is a special subset that has some properties which are essentially being closed under the operations, which is multiplication and inversion. And it also must have the identity in it. Now, a special kind of subgroup is a normal subgroup. In addition to being a subgroup, it has this other property. If you take any element N in the subgroup, capital N stands for normal, and any group element in G, the bigger group, the one that contains N, and you take this product, G times N times G to the minus one, this stays in N. If you want to be fancy, you can call this being closed under conjugation. That's the name that we give to this operation that we're doing. We don't actually need to talk about conjugations, so we're not going to delve deeper into this, but just so you know if you encounter this somewhere else. And the notation we usually use is this one. It's like the less or equal, but we have this triangle on top. And again, I'm not inventing these notations. That's what mathematicians use. Now, if you're wondering what the point of this thing is, normal subgroups are very cool. They have lots of interesting applications that we don't really care about. So we're not going to talk about those. The only reason why I'm talking about normal subgroups is that we need them to define quotient groups. So for our purposes, they're just a technical thing that we need. They're actually very important, especially in representation theory, but that's mostly for finite groups. And I think someone raised their hand. Yes.
Sorry, there's something going on with the PowerPoint and it's sort of flashing into your background screen. It's not stable. Okay. I don't know why.
Okay, I think I know why. Let me fix it. Thank you for letting me know. Was that also the question that someone raised their hand for?
I don't see any raised hand, but yeah, people have been commenting this on the chat.
Okay, that's a very great point. And I should be able to fix it. Just give me a moment.
Well, Matt, he did. Yeah. Somebody raised their hand.
Okay, so right now I post it, so it should be fine, right?
It is not flashing anymore.
Okay, but right now it's paused, so
yeah,
it doesn't mean much. Okay, what about now? Is it flashing?
No, it's not.
Okay, so I fixed it. I think what happens is that I restarted my computer, some setting got reverted, and now it doesn't work anymore. Okay, thank you for pointing that out. I'm sure that was very distracting. Okay, so this is what we need. The only thing I want you to notice is this thing kind of looks like what you do with similarity matrices. When you want to do a similarity transformation for matrices, you have some matrix which is invertible. You multiply on the left, you multiply on the right by the inverse, or vice versa. It doesn't really matter. So again, we're not going to go into details of this thing, but those concepts are very much related. So this is not something crazy. It actually happens in real applications. Okay, now that we have this, we can define the quotient group. This is very important for the isomorphism theorem, and it's going to be important when we talk about representation theory, and specifically why we have spin in quantum mechanics. Okay, so the definition itself is not complicated, just one part is tricky. The idea is we're going to use the normal subgroup N to define an equivalence class, an equivalence relation. And at this point, I hope you remember what the equivalence relations are, and you have reviewed the document that I wrote about it if you didn't. And the idea is we're going to say that two elements of G, small g and small h, are going to be related to each other or equivalent if this happens. H to the minus one times G belongs to N. And another way you can write this, which may be better, is G is related to H if there is some N in small n such that H equals G times N. It's completely equivalent. And the idea is we can go from G to H . Actually, this is a terrible notation. I'm going to use something different than N. I'm going to call it A because my H and my N look so exactly the same. So we can go from G to H by multiplying with something in capital N. So that's our idea of equivalence. Two things are equivalent if you can switch from one to the other by multiplying with something that's in the smaller group. Now that we have this equivalence relation, we can define equivalence classes. So they're just going to be this thing. It's the set of all the elements equivalent to G. This is just a normal construction. Whenever you have an equivalence relation, that's what you will do. So this is just saying that G is equivalent to H. And by the way, I'm not proving that this is an equivalence relation, but it's not difficult to do. You can do that for yourself. Just check that it's symmetric, so that this also implies H equivalent to G, that G is equivalent to itself, and then it's transitive, if you feel like doing this. Okay, at this point, we can define the quotient group. The quotient group, at this point, is a set. It's just a set of all the equivalence classes. We write it as G slash N, and it's pronounced G mod N, because in a sense, we're modding out things. And it's just a set of all the equivalence classes, which is also a standard construction when you have equivalence classes. And at this point, I'm calling it the quotient group for a reason. We want to make it into a group. To do so, we just define an operation. So we need to define, if I give you two equivalence classes, G equivalence class of G, equivalence class of H, how do I multiply these two things? And kind of the obvious choice is just do the multiplication inside the equivalence class. And then you define the inverse to just be, take the inverse inside the equivalence class, and the identity is going to be the equivalence class with the identity. So this is the idea. And I know it's just some abstract thing, but it will be useful soon. So there's something you might have noticed at this point. So is there anything you've noticed that's weird? I'll take that as a no. But you can always use your reactions to tell me if you notice or not, just so they know what's happening. This is weirder than in class thing, so please help me a bit with that. Okay, so something to notice, we did not use the fact that M was normal. I define this thing, and sure, it might be that this thing is only an equivalence relation if n is normal, but that's not true. This is going to be an equivalence relation whenever n is a subgroup. So there's not a big problem. So where does the fact that n is normal come in? And that's exactly for this definition here. Something that happens literally all the time when we're dealing with equivalence classes and defining things on equivalence classes is that we need to make sure that the equivalence class of GH being equal to the equivalence class of G, equivalence class of H does not depend on the representatives. Because we're doing something strange. We're taking a set, which is equivalence class of G, and another one, equivalence class of H. We multiply them by picking two single elements out of this, multiplying them together, and then we do the equivalence class of this. And unless we test it, we don't know if this thing is allowed. Because maybe if you choose different representatives, you're going to get different results. And then this is called ill-defined. And as it turns out, this is okay if n is normal. Okay, so at this point we have a choice. Because I've done this already this morning, I don't want to spend too much time teaching you things. And at the end of the day, I don't know if you really care about the proof of this thing. So if you really want to see the proof of this thing, which is not long and it's not difficult, but I can decide to skip it or not, say yes in the participants tab. And if you don't want to see it, say no, and I'll see how many people want to see it and I'll decide. This is completely up to you. It's a choose your own adventure kind of thing. Okay, so unless I'm mistaken, I think there's roughly enough the same number. That's exactly the same number, yes and no. So what are we going to do? Okay, well, I guess I'm going to very quickly do this, but I'm not going to give you all the details and then you can fill them in yourself. God, this was unlucky. Okay, so by the way, there's an exercise here that you can just do on your own if you feel like it. I think based on experience and the feedback from last time, the exercises don't work too well in the breakout rooms. So I'm going to try different kind of activities rather than doing the exercises. So you can try this on your own and make sure that everything is working as you should. So in this particular case, what you can show is that if you take the set that we're going to call 2z, which is just all the even integers, this is a normal subgroup of z with addition. But most importantly, z2, the integers modulo 2, the way they are defined in the notes that I sent you about equivalence classes, they turn out to be exactly the quotient group z mod 2z. So that's an actual real example of something that's happening of a quotient group. Okay, so very quick proof that this does not depend on the equivalent classes representatives. Suppose that H tilde is equivalent to H and G tilde is equivalent to G. Now this means that H tilde to the minus one H belongs belongs to N, and G tilde to the minus one G belongs to N. Okay, so now we want to show that GH is the same as G tilde H tilde. That's the whole point here. We want to take two sets of representatives and show that the product does not depend on which representatives we chose. But this is equivalent. Two things are in the same equivalence classes, or the equivalent class is the same if GH is equivalent to G tilde H tilde. It's just a different way of writing things. But this is the same as asking that GH tilde to the minus one times GH equals, just belongs to N, just by definition of our equivalence relation. But let's see what happens. Now, remember one of the exercises that you were asked to prove last time was that the inverse of a product is the product of the inverses, but use which places. So we're going to have H tilde to the minus one, G tilde to the minus one times G times H. And that's going to be this thing here. But now we can write this as H to the minus one, I'm going to multiply and divide by H, which means I'm just going to insert an H times H to the minus one in here. That's the identity, so I can always do this. Then we're going to have G tilde to the minus one, G, H. Okay, so now the trick is that this thing here belongs to N because G tilde is equivalent to G. And then this thing here belongs to N because N is normal. And that's where we use the fact that N is normal. And finally, this thing here belongs to N because H tilde and H are equivalent. And the product of three things in N still belongs to N because N is a subgroup. And this concludes the proof. I went a bit fast on this just because I don't want to spend too much time on it. And at the end of the day, it's not really important, but hopefully it's clear to everyone. Let me know if it's not. Okay, by the way, Ivan, do you know if there's a way to clear up all the yes and no's?
Just did it.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so everything clear at this point? And now we can actually get to the main part I wanted to talk about for this. I'm in some trouble zooming things. Okay, which is the isomorphism theorem. Now, technically, this is the first isomorphism theorem. There's a bunch of them. I believe it's four of them. but we only hear about the first one. So from now on, I'm just going to call it the isomorphism theorem. And this theorem is about homomorphism, which is weird because it's called isomorphism theorem. But the reason why is the third point here. We're going to see in a moment. So suppose you have phi from G to H, which is just a group homomorphism. We saw this last time, they are the equivalent of linear maps for groups, and they're just maps that preserve the vector space, the group structure, which means you can essentially pass multiplication in and out of the function. Okay, so now three things happen whenever you have a group homomorphism, no matter which one. The first one is that the image of phi is a subgroup of H. The second one is that the kernel of phi is a normal subgroup of G. It's not just a subgroup, it's a normal one. Now, these two things are very easy to prove and they're not very important. The only reason why they're in the theorem is that without these two, the third point doesn't make any sense. So the third point, which is the actual theorem, is the image of phi, which is a group, is isomorphic to the quotient group G mod kernel of phi. So the first two points are needed because otherwise we cannot talk about isomorphisms because we don't have groups. So the first two things are just to make sure that these and these are actually groups. As an exercise, you can prove the first two points because it's very easy. The last point is also easy if you know the trick, which I do. So I'm just going to tell you what the trick is. And I think it's going to help us understand exactly what's happening. So we have N equals the kernel of phi. That's a normal subgroup. Now, what is the equivalence class of G? Well, by definition, this is just a set of all the H in G. Such that H to the minus one G belongs to the kernel of phi. So if you read it like this, it's not very descriptive. It doesn't really tell you what's happening. But what you can do is this. H to the minus one G belongs to kernel of phi. By definition of what the kernel is means that phi of H to the minus one G is the identity in H. And at this point, we can use the fact that phi is a homomorphism and write this as phi of H to the minus one times phi of G equals EH. I just used the two properties that you can take the multiplication out and then you can take inverses out. So I really did two steps in one. But this means that phi G equals phi of H, because inverses are unique. So at the end of the day, the equivalence class of G is all of those elements that have exactly the same image as G. So this should help you, first of all, understand exactly what's happening. What we're doing is we're considering equivalent things that are identified by the map phi. So phi takes elements in G to elements in H, but if it's not injective, some elements of G are going to end up to the same element in H. And from our point of view, suppose we live in H, that's all we know. We know where stuff arrives, we don't know where it came from, so we're not able to distinguish which element some group element in H came from. And so we just say they're equivalent. And as it turns out, this whole structure works well. It's compatible with all the group axioms. So it ends up being a group. And in the end, we can write in a compact way that the image of phi is isomorphic to G mod kernel of phi. Now, the reason why I'm telling you all these things is that we're going to use these when we talk about the groups. So we're just going to need this notion later. And this appears a lot. In terms of symmetries, you could think of this as you can have some transformations that you identify because you cannot distinguish them. So for example, well, actually, I'm going to tell you when we do the next thing, because you're going to see the GeoGebra activities that actually tie in with this a little bit. Okay, so this is all we have to say about group theory, well, introduction to group theory. I hope this is clear to everyone, and let me know if you have any questions, and as usual, you can ask in the chat. But I want to get to what I need to tell you today, so we have time for activities instead of just me talking. Okay. Okay, so I'm not doing slides anymore now. I'm just going to be writing on a fake piece of paper. And what we're going to talk about now is discrete versus continuous symmetries. And we have a problem, and the problem is we only have 3.5 lectures left, which means I cannot possibly tell you everything about topology and differential structures. So I'm going to have to be very vague with these definitions and hopefully just let you understand what the point is. Now, if you're the kind of person who really wants to know all the details, I'm going to kind of guide you through it. And of course, you can always ask me later at the drop-in meeting or send me an email, and I can guide you to how these things are done properly. I just don't have time. And I'm assuming, because some of you may not know these things, that no one knows anything about topology and manifolds. Maybe I'm wrong, but I cannot assume that. Okay, so we're going to start a GeoGebra thing to see what's happening. I'm going to send you the link so you can open it for yourself and you can interact with it together with me. And you can find the link again in the Google Drive, or I'll just send it to you right now. Okay, so the idea here is we're looking at certain symmetries. I'm just doing rotations. So we have a parameter here that does rotations. You can see you have a point here. You can move around the point. So you can see what's happening. A prime is where the point is sent by the rotation. I'm choosing my parameterization so that the rotation angle is 2π/ε over the number of vertices of this polygon. Just for convenience, you could have just said the angle is epsilon, would have been fine. And you can change the number of vertices just to see what's happening. You can then decide you only want integer steps. So instead of doing 0.1, it just do epsilon equals 0, 1, 2, and so on. So the idea is this. We can rotate by any angle we want, but of these rotations, the ones that actually leave this polygon invariant are going to be discretely many. We only have the integer steps, essentially. So if you fix integer steps, you can see what happens. A prime moves, but the polygon doesn't. And you can do this for any number you want. The increments are going to be smaller and smaller. And this is what happens. So this is going to be our prototype example of what a discrete symmetry is. So one thing to note is you cannot get arbitrarily close between some of these transformations. You can either have zero and then you're the identity, or you jump here and you moved, you cannot get this point A prime arbitrarily close to A while keeping a symmetry of your polygon. So this is in some vague sense what it means to be discrete. Now, before we move to the continuous ones, I actually want to use this example to explain something about the equivalence classes examples from before. If you want to consider only inequivalent rotations, so for example, say we are in here, and I start rotating, you can see that all of these rotations give you different polygons in the end. But once I get to one and I start again, you end up again with the same possible choices of output for your rotations. It doesn't matter what integer you start with, you just have a range from 0 to 1 or 2 to 3 and so on, and you repeat the same thing over and over again. In some sense, from the point of view of this polygon, rotations of with epsilon = 1 and epsilon = 2 and epsilon = 3 are the same, and epsilon = 0.1 and 1.1 and 2.1 and so on are the same. So if you want to consider only the inequivalent ones, what you do is define an equivalence relation, mod out by it, which means just take the equivalence classes, and that's what you end up with. So that's one of the possible applications of the isomorphism theorem, which we've seen before. So I hope this makes things a bit clearer. Okay, so let's see what continuous rotations are instead. So now instead of using a polygon, I'm just going to use a circle. Same idea as before. I have a parameter epsilon. This time I just say the angle is 2 pi epsilon. I could have just said epsilon. It doesn't really matter. I choose 2 pi for some reason. I don't really know why. So we have the point A. We move it around. We have a rotation of the 2D plane. And this time the circle never changes. It doesn't matter what angle I choose. The circle stays into itself. So this means that if we look at rotations, which form a group on their own, and we wonder what is the subgroup of rotations that keeps the circle invariant? Well, it's all of it. And at this point, this is a prototype of a continuous symmetry, because you can move this parameter epsilon and we can make it as small as we want, and we can get as close as we want to a given rotation using this parameter. So in this sense, this is a continuous symmetry. We can make things arbitrarily close to each other, which we cannot do in the other case. I know this is very vague, but it's the best we can do given the limited amount of time. Okay, so there's just a couple of things I want to tell you, then we're going to go with an activity and then we'll be back with more things. So let me just write these things. So the idea is continuous. If there is a parameter, let's call it a continuous parameter, for the group elements. And it's discrete otherwise. Now, this is terribly vague. Ivan is probably dying inside as I write these things, but I cannot do much more than this. If you want much more than this, I'm just going to guide you through what's happening. Now, if you don't understand what I'm talking about right now, that's perfectly fine, because if you don't know what the topology is, you're not going to understand what's happening. But I just want to tell you so you know the idea. So the idea of this continuous parameter is this. We're going to have a parameter epsilon, which is in the group R plus. And we're going to take this thing and associate it to a group element G epsilon, which is in some group G. Now, if there is a topology, on G such that, let me call this map psi, such that psi is continuous, then we say that the set of all the G epsilon such that epsilon is in R, which turns out to be the image of phi, of psi, is continuous. So this is the formal version of these things. It's not yet completely rigorous. I did this very fast and I didn't tell you all about these things, but that's essentially what happens. The point is, my definition from before is extremely vague, because if you don't have a topology on G, there's no point in talking about what it means to be continuous on G. So first of all, you need to make it into topological space, which means give it a topology, and then you can talk about continuity. So that's the idea of what's happening. And if you cannot do this, then you say it's discrete. Now, the reason why this is still vague is that you can very well have something that's discrete a bit and continuous a bit, but we're not going to go there, specifically because you don't care about discrete things in this course because you don't have time. So as far as we're concerned, everything is continuous. It's continuous. We're only going to do continuous symmetries. So I hope this is okay enough. And again, if you didn't understand these last three lines, just ignore them, pretend I didn't write anything. Okay, so before we go and do an activity, are there any questions about these things? Is everything pretty much okay? Okay, I hope it's not too okay, because otherwise the activity is boring, because the activity is exactly talking to each other about what was difficult so far, what was not clear. So I'm going to divide you into breakout rooms. I'm probably going to do two students per room. So you're just going to be one-on-one, just talk to each other, discuss what we've done so far, what you had trouble understanding, if everything was clear. Maybe you both agree everything was clear and just going to have a laugh about it. Maybe someone understood, the other one doesn't, and you can try to explain from your point of view just everything you want. And of course, if both of you didn't understand the same thing, that's a great time to call for help. And so you can either ask for help from me, and if I'm somewhere else, I can send Ivan to help you. So we're going to do this for a few minutes. So example of essentially the first isomorphism theorem and a quotient group. Since you have asked for it, I'm just saying these things for the recording because the previous part was not recorded. So recall that Z2 is the set of these things. There's two elements in it that we call brackets 0, brackets 1, that turns out actually they are equivalence classes. So although for our purposes, it doesn't matter. 0 is the set of all the even integers. So it's going to be the set of 2k such that k is in Z. And 1 is going to be the set of 2k plus 1 such that k is in Z. So they're just two buckets in which we put all the even numbers, all the odd numbers in them. And we just denote them by 0 and 1 because they're just representatives of equivalence classes. So I'm not going to go into this. Hopefully you remember these things or you reviewed the notes I wrote about it. But the nice thing about it is that we can define a sum for these things. So we can say that 0 plus 1 equals 1 plus 0 equals 1. All in brackets, and then 1 plus 1 equals 0, 0 plus 0 equals 0, sorry. So we just define these things, and just as what I had to prove earlier about the normal subgroups, we need to make sure that this makes sense, because these are equivalence classes. So when I say something like this, 1 plus 1 equals 0, what about 3 plus 1? Is that also 0? You need to check that this makes sense. And in this case, it actually does. So we're not going to go there. But they actually don't need to prove it for a reason, because we have the isomorphism theorem. So one thing to note is this. Let's denote 2z as the set of all the even integers, which is the same as this, actually. Just I'm going to call it different. Now, this is a normal subgroup of Z. How do we check this? Well, it's quite easy. Let N equals 2K, which belongs to Z. And then we're going to get A in Z. So these are arbitrary things. And then we're going to do A plus n plus minus a, which is the equivalent of g times n times g to the minus 1, because our operation is the addition. But this is just going to be a minus a plus n, which equals a, n, sorry. Which obviously belongs to 2z because it's an element of 2z. This actually happens all the time, and I mentioned it earlier. If you have an abelian group, all the subgroups are normal, so it doesn't really matter. But this is a normal subgroup, and now we can define z mod 2z. So this is going to be the set of all the equivalence classes of n such that n is in z, by definition. And we're going to define the addition this way. To n plus m equals equivalence class of n plus m. This is a definition that comes from our definition of the quotient group. But now if you look at what the equivalence class of n is, well, this is going to be the set of all the m in z such that, and we need to have an equivalent of n to the minus 1 when we add h to the minus 1 times g. Now the inverse of an integer is just going to be minus that integer. So we get minus m plus n belongs to 2z. But this is the same as the set of all the m, I'm just going to write it in words, m in z such that m minus n is even. Now, there are only two possible things here. Either m is an even integer, and then the equivalence class is all the other even integers because their difference is going to be even, or is odd, and then the equivalence class is all the other odd things. So the only distinct ones are zero, which equals the same zero as above. So it's going to be the set of all the even integers. Or one, which is the set of the k plus one, such that k is in z. So the definition we had before of the integers modulo 2, you can actually think of it as being a quotient group, which is probably the way most people think about it anyway. So the idea is we are identifying things. This is the main point of quotient group. We have something which is z, all the integers, but then we decide, you know what? I only care if these things are even or odd. I don't care about anything else. That's the only feature I want. I'm going to consider them indistinguishable if two things are even. And you put them in buckets, which are the equivalence classes, where all the equivalent things are, and then you define a group notion on what you're left with. And just as a mathematical technicality, this only works if the subgroup is normal. So that's the point of quotient group, and the isomorphism theorem just tells you something about if I have a function between two groups, which is a homomorphism, I can use it to define a quotient group. It's always going to work, just use the kernel. So this is the idea overall that we're working with. We're actually going to see examples when we get to the groups. So this is kind of a preliminary thing, just because of the constraints with the lectures, I need to put all the preliminary things here, and then assuming I have enough time, show you all the cool applications later. So I'm sorry about that. It just, the format is weird because it's all online, and we have only 5 lectures. So everything together gets a bit weird. Okay, so I hope this clarifies things a little bit. And if you have more questions, keep asking, or you can always ask me later in the drop-in session. Okay, so back to what we had. There's a few more things I want to do because then we're going to have an activity that's going to be fun, and I want to give enough time for that. Okay, so we had this idea here of what we have here. this map that takes a parameter that's a real number and maps it into a group element in G. And by the way, I didn't say this, but this should be a group homomorphism. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it really doesn't make sense. Okay, so we're going to actually give a name to this thing. This particular thing that I have here, the set of all the G epsilon, so the image of this map, this is called a one parameter subgroup. So essentially what happens is you take some group and then you have a subgroup of it that you can describe using one parameter. You can use this parameter to move in between the elements of the group. And so for example, the group of rotations that we saw earlier in the GeoGebra example, that's a one parameter group. It's a subgroup of itself. So just let's call it one parameter group, but you have one parameter that describes everything. And so for example, in that case, we can say G theta is a rotation given by cosine theta minus sine theta, cosine theta. And the idea in which this thing is continuous is that these are continuous functions. So if you give a topology to this space by just saying, well, just consider the topology of matrices as the same as R4, then you can make sense of the continuous thing and we have a continuous parameter. You can make this as small as you want. Now, the one parameter subgroups satisfy these particular properties here. We need G zero to be the identity. That's because of the group homomorphism idea. We want to send zero, which is the identity in here, to the identity in this group. And let me put the G here so it's clear what's happening. And we're also going to have G minus epsilon is G epsilon inverse, and also G epsilon plus epsilon prime should be G epsilon times G epsilon prime, which by the way means that the one parameter subgroup is always going to be commutative. This is just a property of these things because this sum is abelian, you can switch things around and then this property is going to tell you that G epsilon prime equals G epsilon. So as I said, this is an example of a one parameter subgroup. In fact, with rotations, G zero is just going to be the identity. Cosine of zero is one, sine of zero is zero. And you can check yourself that indeed G of theta plus theta prime equals G theta times G theta prime. Just have to use some trigonometry gymnastics to prove this thing. But it turns out it actually works. And same about the inverse, you can just do minus theta. But we know this, if you do a rotation by an angle theta, you can undo it by rotating by minus theta. Just do a rotation in the opposite direction. Now, the next thing I wanted to talk about is infinitesimal rotations. Well, infinitesimal group symmetries. Rotations are going to be a particular example. So now that we have this thing, we can talk about infinitesimal. Now, this is not that strange, because it's the same jump that you do when you're doing calculus between continuous functions and differentiable functions. We want to be able to talk about derivatives. So we're going to assume that the map epsilon in R to G epsilon in G not only is continuous, but I want to assume that this is smooth. Now, smooth is a catch-all word that essentially means as nice as we want it to be, or we need it to be. Usually means it's infinity. You can take derivatives of whichever order you want. Sometimes it's enough that it's differentiable. Sometimes it has to be twice differentiable. It really depends on the applications you're working with. Often you just see infinity many times differentiable and you don't have to worry about it. Now you may be wondering, how do I make this function smooth? And same problem as before, I'm being vague here. This only makes sense if we have a differentiable structure on G. And if you know what it means, great. If you don't know what it means, just pretend there's a notion of this thing being smooth that you're happy with. You're essentially making G into a manifold. We're going to see these things later when we talk about Lie groups. I don't want to get there yet. I just want to do things the physicist way right now, which is describing infinitesimal transformations in terms of linearizations. We're going to need this for Noether's theorem. So if this map is smooth, you can linearize it. Which means we can say that G epsilon equals, we're going to have essentially a Taylor expansion around epsilon equals zero. So we're going to have G zero plus epsilon, the derivative with respect to epsilon of G epsilon evaluated at epsilon equals zero, plus order of epsilon squared. Or sometimes just drop the order of epsilon squared and say the infinitesimal one is where you stop. So the idea is that this thing here is the infinitesimal. Sometimes this one here really depends on who's defining these things. I'm going to add this one. This is the infinitesimal. Symmetry. So the idea is, just to recap, an infinitesimal symmetry is going to be something of the form, remember that G0 must be the identity. So you can see something of the form E plus some parameter epsilon, which multiplies something I'm just going to call X plus O, the epsilon squared, where X is obtained by taking the derivative at epsilon equals zero of some continuous one group, one parameter subgroup. And let me give you an example of this thing, and then we're just going to jump into the activity because I probably talked too much today. So hopefully it's going to be clearer with the example. If we go back to our rotations, I'm just going to call them r theta so we don't get confused. So r theta is just going to be our rotation cosine theta, sine theta minus sine theta, cosine theta. Now, because we're matrices, we have a notion of differential structure. You essentially just take derivatives entry by entry and you're going to be fine. So this means we can define d over d theta at theta equals zero of r theta. So what happens when we take derivatives? Again, entry by entry. Let me write this. We're going to take the derivative of cosine of theta and then plug in theta equals zero. Now this is going to be minus sine. You plug in zero, you get zero. So it just disappears. Same here. Well, the derivative of sine is cosine of theta, but then you plug in theta equals zero and it gives you one. And this is going to give us minus one. So we're going to end up with something that looks like this. And this means that if you want to write a Taylor expansion of this thing, you can. You can write r theta equals the identity plus theta, which multiplies 0, 1, minus 1, 0, plus things of order theta squared. And in fact, this particular thing, you can just use the Taylor series of cosine and sine, plug them in, and then expand. So you don't even have to go and do these things. So for certain notions of these group actions, it's kind of obvious what the differential structure is. And for our purposes, this is going to be the case. I just wanted to give you an idea that's more general, but we're just going to deal with matrixly groups, which means everything we deal with is going to be matrices, and matrices we know how to differentiate. So everything is going to be fine. So this here is an infinitesimal rotation. Which is just a linearized rotation. It's not really a rotation anymore. It's not an element of the group, but you can use it to make an approximation of rotations. And in fact, and we're going to see this later, you can actually go back. You can take this infinitesimal thing and you can reconstruct the actual rotation out of it, which is the very cool thing about this, which is not obvious at all. When you do calculus things, you take the derivative of a function and you're done. You lost all the information. But when you have the groups, because of the group structure, you can linearize and then do stuff with the linearization and then get back. And that's the really cool thing about the groups. But we're going to get there later. Okay, so at this point, I'm not going to tell you about symmetries of an action. I'm just going to tell you the action next time, which fits nicely anyway. Oh yes, someone wrote that I forgot to put a one here. I actually did exactly the same mistake this morning. You just don't want to put a one there. Just get on zero mode. Okay, so what we're going to do now is something fun instead of the boring things we've done so far. I mean, they're not boring, but they can be. So what we're going to do is we're going to come up with icos. Now, I hope everyone knows what these are. If you don't know, let's just get an idea. And you can see some examples here. They are essentially little poems, and they are constructed with some very simple rules. There's three lines. The first one has 5 syllables. The next one has 7 syllables. The next one has 5 syllables. So the idea is I'm going to divide you into groups, and each group needs to come up with an IQ about things we've done so far. It can be the group theory things, the continuous symmetries, and that's actually all we've done so far. So you cannot really talk about actions, but anything else that you know already about these things, feel free to do that. So you're going to have essentially all the time that's left. I may just call you back at the very end, so they ask you to do another survey like last time. But other than that, your time to do this, and I created a Google Doc. You can find the link in here, and I'm going to send it to you. You should all have writing access to this. So I would like each room to actually write down their icos here. They're going to be anonymous. It's nice to have them, and then everyone can see what everyone else is doing. And in case you're wondering, why am I doing this crazy activity? There's actually a point. The idea is that by doing this thing, you're going to be synthesizing one of those two, the notions that you learned. By doing this thing, hopefully you're going to actually learn more about what's really happening and what's important about these notions. And by the way, this is exactly what I do when I prepare my lectures. I have all this material and I have to figure out of all these things, what is important and what can I skip. And sometimes I decide wrong, but hopefully most of the time it's okay.